cats from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Weather tonight, partly cloudy skies, lows near 53, northwest winds up to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny, highs 62 to 67, northwest winds, overnight lows in the upper 40s.
It is a famine in 2025. It is a famine openly promoted by some Israeli leaders as a weapon of war.
UN officials announce a famine in Gaza City, describing catastrophic conditions.
It's Friday, August 22nd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. 20 years after Hurricane Katrina, how has the school system in New Orleans evolved?
Not having certified teachers from the community was not necessarily the right way to go.
Also, hunting wolves has long been a way to protect livestock, but a new study questions that strategy.
Livestock predation can be a huge challenge that we don't have a great solution for yet.
Meanwhile, the FBI conducts a search at the home of former National Security Advisor John Bolton.
And the Federal Reserve may soon be cutting interest rates.
Those stories after the summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. The UN's Emergency Relief Coordinator has lashed out at Israel, saying the famine in Gaza could have been prevented. His remarks come after the world's leading authority on food and security said more than a half million people in Gaza face catastrophic levels of hunger. NPR's Jackie Northam has more from Tel Aviv.
UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Tom Fletcher said the report by the Integrated Food Security Phase classification should be read in sorrow and in anger. He said the Gaza famine was predictable and openly promoted by some Israeli leaders as a weapon of war.
A famine caused by cruelty, justified by revenge, enabled by indifference, and sustained by complicity.
Fletcher called on Israel to allow food and other humanitarian aid into Gaza. Israeli officials said the report's findings were false and biased, and that Israel had taken steps recently to allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The FBI has searched the home of former National Security Advisor John Bolton. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports Bolton has become a sharp critic of President Trump.
The FBI says it pursued court-authorized activity at Bolton's Maryland home. As Director Kash Patel posted on social media, no one is above the law. Bolton had worked on national security issues for about a year during the first Trump administration, but he later criticized Trump in a tell-all book. The president's allies have since raised questions about Bolton's handling of classified documents, which Bolton describes as retaliation. This year, the Trump administration yanked Bolton's security detail, which was in place because of threats from Iran. The president told reporters he knew nothing about the FBI search and said Bolton could be a, quote, very unpatriotic guy. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell signaled the possibility of lower interest rates in the months to come. Speaking at the Fed's annual meeting in Jackson Hole, Wyoming today, Powell said the balance of risks across the economy has started to shift between the Fed's goal of full employment and stable prices.
The stability of the unemployment rate and other labor market measures allows us to proceed carefully as we consider changes to our policy stance.
And that raises the odds the Fed will lower borrowing costs next month. But he says there are concerns. Powell says while the labor market is in good shape and the economy has shown resilience, President Trump's tariffs are causing the risk that inflation could rise again. This is Powell's last address to the annual Jackson Hole conference as Fed chair. He and his central bank colleagues had been under intense pressure from Trump to lower interest rates. His comments sent Wall Street sharply higher, the Dow up 846 points, the Nasdaq up 396. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A tour bus returning to New York City from Niagara Falls crashed on an interstate highway today with multiple casualties. The accident happened near Pembroke, about 25 miles east of Buffalo. Police say the bus driver lost control, went into a median, and ended up in a ditch. People inside were ejected as the windows shattered. The driver survived. Several ambulances and medical helicopters transported patients to hospitals. The New York State Thruway Authority shut down a stretch of the roadway, urging drivers to avoid the area. Many people think using health insurance means they'll get the best deal on health care. But in fact, sometimes it's much cheaper to pay for health care in cash. Alex Olgan has more.
The differences can be stark. One woman's insurance was billed more than 10 times the cash rate for a genetic test during pregnancy. GBuy, with Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, found among hospitals that publish prices, half of them set cash rates lower than their middle-of-the-road insurer price for lab tests, x-rays, and some surgeries.
So this is totally surprising and ruined my faith in the pricing advantage of insurance companies.
Buy says healthcare providers like cash because they can collect fast and avoid administrative headaches. But for consumers shelling out hundreds or thousands every month for insurance coverage, it's a frustrating dynamic. For NPR News, I'm Alex Olgan.
And again on Wall Street, all three major indices higher by the closing bell. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Grand Rapids River Fest is Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. Want to volunteer at the event? Head to GrandRapidsRiverFest.com under Get Involved. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
Was considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. UN officials are calling this a moment of shame as they announce a famine in Gaza City. UN-backed food experts are reporting that more than 500,000 people in the northern Gaza Strip are facing what they call catastrophic conditions. They are urging Israel to agree to a ceasefire and to lift restrictions on aid. But Israel denies there is a famine, and the U.S. blames Hamas for the current situation in the Gaza Strip. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The lead U.N. humanitarian official, Tom Fletcher, says the world should be shocked by the report, which he says includes, quote, irrefutable testimony.
It is a famine in 2025, a 21st century famine, watched over by drones and the most advanced military technology in history. It is a famine openly promoted by some Israeli leaders as a weapon of war.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu calls it an outright lie and says the only ones being intentionally starved in Gaza are the Israeli hostages held by Hamas. The State Department says Hamas is promoting a, quote, false narrative of deliberate mass starvation to put political pressure on Israel. It also suggests that the authors of the report may have changed the definition for what constitutes a famine. But the World Food Program's Jean-Martin Bauer says this report was written by well-known experts who have been analyzing food security data for decades.
This is the gold standard in terms of analysis for food security and nutrition worldwide.
The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC as it's known, ranks food insecurity on a scale of 1 to 5. Northern Gaza is now listed as Phase 5, a famine, and the report warns that other areas could reach that level in the coming weeks. Lise Grande, who was the Biden administration's point person on humanitarian aid for Gaza, was stunned to read this.
I did not envision, and I don't think any of us who were in Gaza at the time envisioned that the situation would become this bad.
The Trump administration did not fill her job when she left, and rather than working through the UN, it has backed a new aid program at distribution centers in areas controlled by the Israeli military. Grande wouldn't comment on that, but says there is only one way to reverse this man-made famine.
And the way to reverse it is to get as much aid as possible and as quickly as possible. The key to that is the Israelis need to open up access into the Gaza Strip. That's the solution. Everybody knows it. That has to be the number one priority right now.
Kate Phillips-Barrasso of Mercy Corps agrees.
We are talking about people starving to death, literally miles away from where there are organizations that are desperately trying to provide them this assistance.
Her aid group has been working in Gaza for decades, but hasn't been able to do much in recent months after Israel ended a two-month ceasefire in March. Local staff in Gaza are having a hard time feeding their own family, she says, and the aid they want to deliver can't get through Israeli checkpoints. Philip Sparrasso wants the Trump administration to push harder for a ceasefire that would allow the aid to flow. At the moment, though, Israel is calling up more reservists for a potential offensive in Gaza City.
With the events going on around Gaza City right now, we're looking at a situation that may accelerate the suffering as opposed to creating the conditions for alleviating it. So the U.S. needs to be involved in figuring this out as soon as possible, because we have no time left for the people of Gaza.
Although he has acknowledged starvation in Gaza, President Trump still backs Israel's position, accusing Hamas of extortion by continuing to hold hostages. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
After Hurricane Katrina flooded New Orleans 20 years ago, public education in the city came to a complete stop. And when schools reopened, many of the city's educators didn't get their jobs back. Instead, they were replaced with young people who were new to teaching and new to New Orleans. Aubrey Juhas of member station WWNO spoke with two teachers on opposite sides of that divide.
Even when she was a little kid growing up in New Orleans, Stacy Gilbert knew she wanted to be a teacher.
Movies like with the blind girl, I can't remember the name.
Oh, yeah.
Helen Keller. Helen Keller. And other movies I would see and say, that's the type of children I want to teach.
When Hurricane Katrina hit her hometown in 2005, Gilbert had been teaching special education for almost two decades.
I can still remember that particular Friday. And just thinking, okay, we're going to evacuate, but we'll be back.
But Gilbert didn't come back for months. And eventually, teaching positions like hers started being filled with a different kind of teacher.
My mom was a little worried about the weather.
Lauren Jewett had never been to New Orleans when she joined Teach for America, or TFA. The two-year program places people, mostly recent college grads, in public schools that need teachers. Jewett hadn't gone to college to be a teacher. But that wasn't unusual for TFA. The program began with a crash course, an attempt to cram much of what new teachers need to know into just a few weeks.
Sessions on like sensitivity around working with different communities, like that's lifelong work. And how do you fit that in a six-week boot camp that involves many other topics?
Before the storm, the majority of New Orleans teachers resembled Stacy Gilbert. They were Black women who were certified to teach and on average had about 15 years of experience. But by the time Jewett arrived in 2009, the percentage of white teachers was growing quickly. Many were out-of-towners who were brand new to teaching.
The people that did come down, they were well-meaning, but they weren't trained.
Renee Akbar has trained teachers at Xavier University of Louisiana, one of the city's HBCUs, for over 20 years. She says before the storm, the city's teachers had deep roots in their communities.
They probably taught the aunties, the uncles, the grandma even, some of them. That makes a world of difference when you want kids to be successful.
For decades, New Orleans schools had been struggling. In 2005, the state graded most of them as failing. After Katrina, state officials took over many of the schools and turned them into charter schools. When veteran teachers like Stacy Gilbert applied for a job, they had to take a proficiency exam.
That was really a slap in the face, like, wow, to get my job, you want me to take a test?
Less than a third of pre-Katrina teachers returned to the system. Others, like Gilbert, got jobs teaching elsewhere in the state. Meanwhile, newer teachers like Jewett were taking on a lot of responsibility. After just 2 years of teaching special education, she became the expert on staff, a common story in a system full of newbies.
I had to teach myself. Like, there wasn't a high level of years of experience, too, in our building.
By 2013, the majority of New Orleans teachers had been on the job less than 5 years, and turnover had doubled. That wasn't good for students. And Akbar at Xavier University says charter schools noticed.
Not having certified teachers from the community was not necessarily the right way to go.
She says many TFA recruits didn't stick around, and schools started hiring veteran teachers again. Fast forward to today, and New Orleans' teaching force looks more like it used to.
And somehow or the other, it kind of balanced off.
Akbar says charter schools now rely on partnerships with local universities, like hers, to hire certified teachers with ties to the city.
Ryan?
Yeah, I'm Ryan.
Nice teachers like Stacey Gilbert's son, Ryan Gilbert.
When I told my parents that I was changing my major to education, I think they were confused.
He's a high school science teacher in New Orleans and recently started his 11th year in the classroom.
And it was the whole, like, teachers don't make any money. And then from my mom, it was, it's not what it used to be.
But with time, his mom says she came around.
I was really proud of him and realized now that is where he should be. Because the same passion I have about teaching, that's what he has.
Teaching has become Lauren Jewett's passion, too. After 16 years, she says New Orleans is now her home.
I think I also feel very rooted to this place because it's also where I kind of grew up.
Today, there's room for teachers like her, who came after Katrina and chose to stay, alongside people who have always called the city home. For NPR News, I'm Aubrey Juhas in New Orleans.
Guitarist and vocalist Brent Hinds of the heavy metal band Mastodon died this week. He was 51 and was involved in a motorcycle accident in Atlanta. For more than two decades, Hinds and his bandmates became known within the metal scene for complicated riffs and epic storytelling. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has this appreciation.
Before he ever picked up a guitar, William Brent Hinds played the banjo.
I grew up in Helena, Alabama, and I was just a normal kid that liked to wear capes and ride bikes, you know?
That's Hinds speaking on Fret 12's The Sound and Story series. The young Hinds also studied classical guitar at the Alabama School of Fine Arts. After that, he moved to Atlanta and co-founded Mastodon. His hybrid picking guitar style meshed with the band's penchant for very heavy riffs. As Hinds told Fret 12,
I got a certain feeling when we played the music that I'd never gotten from any other band, that this band was like locked in, it was tighter.
The band was also known for narrative concept albums on mythic subjects. Their 2004 album Leviathan was based on Herman Melville's Moby Dick. As Mastodon's rhythm guitarist Bill Keller told NPR in 2007,
imagery and storytelling and the art of the whole thing is just interesting to us to write about that stuff and have the artwork on the cover and just the mystique of it all, you know.
That devotion to elaborate storytelling and ferocious music won them fans in high places. The band appeared on the HBO series Game of Thrones and recorded a song inspired by the show. We'll tell why we- Hinds parted from Mastodon earlier this year. He continued playing with his band Fiend Without a Face this summer. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News. Hide away your children, then
hide away yourself. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Thanks to our listeners, we've raised over $160,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public media. KAXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate, share our work, or buy a ticket to Grand Rapids Riverfest. Visit kaxe.org. We receive support from Headwaters Music and Arts in downtown Bemidji, offering music lessons and art programming for all ages. More at headwatersmusicandarts.org or on Facebook and Instagram. The 19th annual White Oak Antique Tractor Show is August 23rd and 24th, 1 mile north of Deer River on Highway 6. Each day will feature a pancake breakfast and parade, as well as demos throughout the day, raffle for a 1947 Farmel tractor, and a farmer's market, free and open to all. We receive support from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure, with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit, Reclaimed, Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5, and Sundays 11 to 4. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op in Bemidji, partnering with local farms for over two decades to provide fresh and local foods, promoting sustainability through local buying. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. Now back to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at VisitSPC.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Congress spent most of the summer battling over President Trump's signature legislation, officially named the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. It was signed into law last month. Now comes the political fight over the impact of the package, even as many of its provisions have yet to take effect. Some 15 months before the midterm elections, Democrats are already crafting their message around federal cuts to Medicaid. NPR National political correspondent Don Gagne reports from Michigan.
When Sharon Watson's son, Eli, was just shy of his fourth birthday, she came downstairs one day to find him having a seizure.
It just kept going and going and going, and 5 minutes passed and he was still going, and his lips started to turn blue and his fingertips started to turn blue, and it looked like he was having trouble breathing.
Eli was diagnosed with epilepsy, which meant a battery of testing, daily medications, and frequent doctor visits. Watson's family enrolled in Medicaid after her husband left the Navy and couldn't work due to disability. Now the mother of three is worried about whether the Republican tax and spending bill, with its new work requirements and changes to some state funding mechanisms, will affect her eligibility or her coverage.
I feel like one of the hardest things about this is how many uncertainties there are.
45-year-old Jennifer Midland is also worried about Medicaid cuts. In her case, she never imagined she'd find herself in need of the service until recently. Then she got in a car accident and things started to cascade.
I was earning more than six figures. I have kids. I'm in a professional setting. And within 4 months, I go from that to being unemployed and desperately in need of medical care with nowhere to go.
Brian Peters, CEO of the Michigan Health and Hospitals Association, says it's too early to know exactly how the Republican bill will affect health care in Michigan. But he expects significant impacts on coverage. State Health Department data suggests more than a quarter of the state's population are Medicaid recipients.
The state of Michigan has estimated that as many as 700,000 Michiganders could lose coverage. Much of that relates to the potential for these new requirements for people to document every 6 months their eligibility for the program.
It's those numbers and stories like Watson's and Midland's that Democrats are highlighting as they campaign against Trump's bill. In fact, Democrats hope to put the bill, which polling has shown to be very unpopular with the public, in the middle of every battleground congressional race next year. And it's already started.
3 weeks ago, Congress passed Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill.
That's Michigan Democratic Party Chair Curtis Hertel hosting a town hall in Macomb County in a swing district with an open house race next year. He brought along high-profile special guests, former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords and her husband, Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona. The senator took the mic and mocked Republicans who claim misgivings about the bill, but then voted for it.
I mean, there are, you know, members who were like, well, we can't cut funding to Medicaid.
This is a bad decision. This came from Republicans. But ultimately, you saw what happened.
Michigan Democrats have been holding events like this across the state. Meanwhile, Republicans say Democrats are fear-mongering about the cuts. They say the bill only targets, quote, waste, fraud, and abuse. But the Hospital Association's Brian Peters says there's no evidence of such widespread waste and abuse.
The reality is, when you look at the Medicaid population here in the state of Michigan, we know that almost all of those folks are working and working full time.
State and local Republican Party officials declined or didn't respond to multiple interview requests for this story. Michigan State University political science professor Corwin Smith says the waste and fraud argument can cut two ways.
It resonates with voters to say there's waste and fraud. It's waste and fraud, though, when you find out that your hospital might be considered waste and fraud, and you're like, that provides essential services, that's a much different story suddenly.
Many of the bill's Medicaid provisions won't take effect until after the 2026 midterms. That leaves both parties with time to try to shape the narrative around the bill. In fact, in the coming weeks, Trump's cabinet secretaries will be hitting the road to sell what is his signature legislative package, including a stop in Michigan. Don Gagne, NPR News, Detroit.
For more than 3 years, family members of the victims of the Uvalde school shooting have waited for access to records of that day. 19 students and two teachers died in that shooting back in May of 2022 after law enforcement took more than an hour to confront the gunman. The victims' families believe that the records might reveal whether children could have been saved if law enforcement had acted more quickly. But the documents released last week gave rise to even more questions for the families. Jerry Clayton from Texas Public Radio has more.
Uvalde school administrators last week released the files, including video, text, emails, and other materials. Uvalde County officials also released their files. A law firm representing several news organizations sent a letter this week demanding the school district, the county, and the Department of Public Safety release additional files. Manuel Riso is the uncle and godfather of 9-year-old fourth grader Jackie Cazares, who was killed in the attack. He's seen most of the released material. He says he's disappointed that all the files related to the shooting have not been released. Riso says most of the video released from the county was sound only because officers had put on their body armor over their body-worn cameras.
And they had close to 77 minutes to clear that mistake and put their body cameras in front of their armor, and they chose not to.
A district judge ordered the state in June 2023 to release the video and other documents that would likely give a clearer picture of the botched response by law enforcement. The DPS has appealed that decision. Now, in Texas' second special legislative session, Governor Greg Abbott is pushing for a new law that would limit the release of information to the public by law enforcement. Families fear that if that bill passes, they may never fully see what happened on that day. Jackie's mother, Gloria Cazares, spoke before the Uvalde School District Board in July.
You all owe it to Jackie, to her classmates, to her teachers, and to every single family member that has forever been changed.
Manuel Riso says his niece might still be alive had it not been for the mistakes made by law enforcement.
She was one of the victims who still was alive when they moved her out of the classroom. And she died at the hospital.
More than a dozen officers have been disciplined since the shooting. The school police chief at the time and another former officer faced child endangerment charges. For NPR News, I'm Jerry Clayton in San Antonio.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Learn about Dutch oven cooking at Lake Bemidji State Park tomorrow at 1:30. meet at the fire ring by the dining hall. Seasoned chefs and outdoor enthusiasts will teach you how to care for a Dutch oven, and you'll also get to enjoy some tasty treats. Now it's time for the Up North Report from our KAXE-KBXE news team.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Minnesota government remains under scrutiny over high-profile fraud cases, mainly involving people posing as service providers who get reimbursements through phony billing. A company assisting government agencies describes this as a growing threat. The Minnesota Department of Human Services plans to redesign a housing stabilization program after shutting it down earlier this month. The agency said it had no choice after suspending payments to dozens of providers based upon credible allegations of fraud. Asia Brown with Forward Platform says it's not surprising to hear, noting many state and local governments rely on antiquated monitoring systems.
With the expansion and sophistication of technology, it's much easier to create fraudulent documents.
She recommends safeguards that include, quote, multi-point checks with more efficiencies. Experts note it can take a long time to build criminal cases in these situations. This year, Minnesota approved new prevention measures, but lawmakers acknowledge the need for more. State leaders also announced this year they were exploring a pilot system involving artificial intelligence, a move Brown says is needed. She says departments have to fight back with improved technology that's becoming less expensive to implement. Brown says fraud can be frustrating for taxpayers to hear, but stressed there should be a careful approach so that program recipients aren't burdened with added hoops to jump through.
There's an increase in number of American families that need vital aid, and it's essential that we really optimize the way that we're able to deliver these funds to recipients and that we also protect funds from being just redirected.
The dynamic involving tougher eligibility is playing out more so at the federal level. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act pushed through Congress by Republicans includes controversial work requirements for Medicaid. Republicans contend they'll help eliminate fraud and waste, but opponents say they target the wrong people and lead to administrative headaches. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. Minnesota's Department of Employment and Economic Development announced $3.6 million in funding to help businesses enter the state's cannabis industry as well as train workers. The three programs, Can Navigate, Can Startup, and Can Train, offer funding and technical support to start and expand cannabis businesses in Minnesota, as well as grants to workforce training organizations for cannabis job training. They were created in the 2023 legislature when lawmakers legalized adult-use cannabis in the state. White Earth Tribal and Community College will be granted $500,000 under the CanTrain program. The public is invited to learn more about Crow Wing County's long-range transportation plan at an upcoming public meeting. Chelsea Perkins gives us the details.
The County Highway Department finished the initial phase of public engagement for the plan and analyzed the feedback to identify trends and themes. More than 500 comments came in through a survey and an interactive map. The meeting will include a presentation on those themes, opportunities to provide more feedback, and talk with Crow Wing County Highway staff. The transportation plan will help identify and prioritize long-term investments focused on vehicle and pedestrian safety, road maintenance, and to prepare for future growth and change. In 2024, Crow Wing was identified as one of 10 counties in the state projected for significant population growth. It's the only one outside of the Twin Cities and Rochester metropolitan areas. The meeting is 6 to 7:30 p.m. Thursday at the Crow Wing County Land Services Building in Brainerd. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
As the new school year approaches, the backpack program provided by Second Harvest Northland begins its 15th year. Beginning in 2010 as the Superior School District's Nutrition on Weekend program, it now provides weekend food to children at schools within 22 different Northeast Minnesota and Northwest Wisconsin communities, reaching more than 1,600 students each week, according to a news release. In the 15-county service region served by Second Harvest Northland, the organization says 1 in 6 children are food insecure. During the week, free and reduced-price lunches at school help children meet their nutritional needs and alleviate parental stress. But for many families, weekends present a gap in reliable access to food. The backpack program fills this gap by ensuring students head home at the end of the week with a discreet bag of nutritious, easy-to-open, easy-to-prepare food, such as fruits, vegetables, ready-to-eat meals, and cereal. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell signaled today that the central bank could soon be ready to cut interest rates. That triggered a rally in the stock market, where the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 846 points. That's almost 2%. Powell spoke to a gathering of economists and central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, about how the Trump administration's tariffs and immigration crackdown are affecting the U.S. economy. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi. Okay, so let me get this straight. The central bank has voted 5 times this year not to cut its benchmark interest rate, right? Including just last month. So what's changed here?
Yeah, 2 days after that last Fed meeting in July, we got a report suggesting the job market is a lot weaker than we thought. Job gains in July were smaller than expected. Job gains for May and June were pretty much wiped out. Now, the unemployment rate is still very low, just 4.2%, but that's largely because the workforce is growing very slowly, or maybe even shrinking. Immigration's pretty much dried up. At the same time, a lot of baby boomers are retiring. So even though the job market looks to be in balance right now, Powell says it's a precarious balance.
This unusual situation suggests that downside risks to employment are rising. And if those risks materialize, they can do so quickly in the form of sharply higher layoffs and rising unemployment.
Powell says that uneasy job market may warrant a cut in interest rates, and that was enough to cheer stock market investors who were already betting on a rate cut at the next Fed meeting in September. Now, Powell stopped short of promising that. He says he and his colleagues will continue to watch the incoming data on both jobs and inflation.
Okay, so what is happening with inflation right now?
Well, it's come down a lot from the 9% range we saw a few years ago, but it's still higher than the Fed would like, and lately it's been moving in the wrong direction, partly as a result of President Trump's tariffs.
The effects of tariffs on consumer prices are now clearly visible. We expect those effects to accumulate over coming months with high uncertainty about both timing and amounts. The question that matters for monetary policy is whether these price increases are likely to materially raise the risk of an ongoing inflation problem.
Some of Powell's colleagues at the Fed have argued that while tariffs will cause a one-time jump in prices, they probably won't keep pushing prices up month after month. And Powell says that's probably right, but he's still cautious. He doesn't want the Fed to be complacent about a possible rekindling of inflation.
Sure. But, I mean, you know, President Trump, he's been waging a pretty high-pressure campaign to get Powell and his colleagues to lower interest rates. But isn't that the kind of political pressure that the Fed is supposed to be insulated from?
Yes, it is. And Powell did not talk about the president's efforts today, but they have been intense. Trump's been very critical of Powell himself. And just today, the president threatened to fire another member of the Fed's governing board, Lisa Cook, after a Trump ally accused Cook of making false statements on a mortgage application. Now, Cook has said she won't be bullied, and she's preparing to answer questions about the mortgage matter. In the face of all this pressure, other central bankers have been speaking up in defense of the Fed and Powell. This is European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde speaking at a panel discussion with other central bankers last month.
I think I speak for myself, but I speak for all colleagues on the panel. I think we would do exactly the same thing as our colleague Jay Powell does. The same thing. right?
Yes.
Well, this is Powell's last appearance at the Jackson Hole meeting before his term as Fed chair expires, and he got a standing ovation.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
Today, we're tracking two developments from the Justice Department. This morning, the FBI searched both the home and office of John Bolton, who served as national security advisor during President Trump's first term. Bolton later emerged as a vocal critic of the president. And then this afternoon, the department released transcripts of its interviews with Ghislaine Maxwell, the longtime associate of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The Trump administration has been under fire for its handling of the Epstein matter. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas is here in studio, has been following this. Hi there.
Hi there.
Ryan, let's start with John Bolton. What can you tell us about the search today and what the FBI is investigating?
Well, the FBI conducted searches, as you said, of Bolton's home in Bethesda, Maryland, which is right outside of D.C., as well as his office in downtown D.C. Now, in both instances, the FBI says that it was conducting court-authorized searches. It says there's no threat to public safety. The FBI didn't provide any more details, but two people familiar with the matter tell me that this is tied to an investigation into Bolton's handling or potential mishandling of classified documents.
And Ryan, we know that Bolton was involved in a legal battle with President Trump years ago during the first Trump administration. Is this the same legal fight?
It's not immediately clear. The Justice Department during Trump's first term sued Bolton to try to block publication of his book, a memoir about his time in the Trump White House. The Trump administration argued that the book had classified information in it. Bolton said he moved forward with the book only after it had been cleared by administration officials. In the end, the Justice Department's lawsuit didn't succeed. Bolton's book was published. It was in bookstores. And for years now, Bolton has been a very outspoken critic, as you said, of President Trump. Trump, for his part, has also taken plenty of swipes himself at Bolton, including today.
I'm not a fan of John Bolton. I thought he was a sleazebag, actually. And he suffers major Trump derangement syndrome.
Now, Trump also said today that he didn't know anything about the FBI's actions. He said he tries to stay out of this sort of thing. He did add, though, that he is the chief law enforcement officer. And he also brought up that the FBI searched his Mar-a-Lago home for classified documents, which, of course, is a topic that he frequently brings up when he rails against the so-called deep state, against his perceived enemies, and talks about the need for revenge.
Right. And we know that Trump campaigned on seeking vengeance against people he perceives as enemies. So, Ryan, does that raise concerns about whether the FBI actions today are driven by politics rather than legitimate investigative concerns?
Well, look, there's a lot that we don't know about this investigation at this point. Now, the FBI says these were, as I said, court-authorized searches, which would mean that magistrate judges would have had to sign off on them. Vice President J.D. Vance was on NBC today. He denied that Bolton is being targeted because he's a Trump critic.
We're in the very early stages of an ongoing investigation into John Bolton. I will say we're going to let that investigation proceed.
Now, Vance also said this.
Our focus here is on, did he break the law? Did he commit crimes against the American people? If so, then he deserves to be prosecuted.
Now, it's highly unusual, some people would even say inappropriate, for a White House official, let alone the vice president, to be talking about an ongoing investigation. It's also curious, I'll say, that he's saying, we are doing this, and it's not the Justice Department. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, the Justice Department has been independent from the White House when it comes to investigations and prosecutions, and that's to make sure that decisions are not and do not appear to be driven by politics. And so concerns about politics driving decisions now are not just because of Bolton. I'll remind you that the Justice Department recently opened investigations into two other prominent Trump critics, California Democratic Senator Adam Schiff and New York Attorney General Letitia James.
Right. Quickly, Ryan, while we still have you, what can you tell us about the transcripts that the Justice Department just released from its Ghislaine Maxwell interview?
Right. These are transcripts from an interview done last month by Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, who previously served as Trump's personal attorney. The Justice Department has in the past raised questions about Maxwell's credibility. She at one point faced perjury charges for allegedly lying in a deposition. She was also convicted of helping Epstein sexually abuse underage women. The Justice Department, though, ultimately decided that an interview was something that they wanted to do, and that's in part because they wanted to try to tamp down the public uproar over its handling of the Epstein files.
And NPR's Ryan Lucas, thanks as always.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
President Trump paid a visit yesterday to National Guardsmen and law enforcement officers who are stationed in Washington, D.C. as part of his mission to crack down on crime. The U.S. Attorney for D.C., Jeanine Pirro, pledged harsh punishment for those who are arrested.
I am making sure that we back the blue to the hilt. Every arrest you make, we're going to the longest way to make sure that we charge in those cases.
The Trump administration says it has now arrested more than 700 people in the district. NPR criminal justice reporter Meg Anderson is here to tell us what we can and cannot conclude from those numbers. Hi, Meg.
Hey.
Hey. Okay, so what more do we know about these arrests so far?
Yeah, so we're dealing with two separate numbers, one from the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department and one from the White House. Both have said there may be overlap. We don't know how much overlap there is. MPD says there were about 800 arrests in the first 10 days of this crackdown compared to previous years. That is a ramp up. It's about 25% more than the same period last year, which, wow, you know, isn't surprising given the hundreds of federal agents out on the street.
Right. Well, what can you tell us about who is being arrested exactly?
Yeah, so first, NPR has asked for a full list of names of the people who have been arrested from both MPD and from the Trump administration. Neither has provided it. So we don't know, you know, who any of these people are, whether they're still in custody. We don't have a full picture of who was arrested for what and who did the arresting. The White House has indicated that about 40% of their arrests have been immigration related. Once you factor out those arrests, they say about half happened in the areas of D.C. with the highest violence crime rates, but without more information, we don't really have any way to independently confirm that.
Okay, then what can we conclude from all of this arrest data?
In short, not a lot. Arrests mean arrests. They do not necessarily translate to actual crimes. Typically, only a portion of arrests lead to charges, an even smaller amount lead to convictions. Police experts use the term flooding the zone for this type of law enforcement, and it can lead to arrests simply because officers are out there looking for people to arrest. I spoke to Tahir Duckett about that. He directs the Center for Innovations in Community Safety at Georgetown Law.
You might arrest someone for getting too close to a police officer, and then you could call it assault. You might arrest someone who is protesting but ends up on private property, and then you call it trespassing. So these are all choices, and those choices oftentimes reflect the priority of a law enforcement agency.
And we have seen that this week. So, you know, many people saw the video of the guy that threw a sandwich at a federal agent.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's now facing a federal assault charge for that.
Assault for a sandwich. Okay. Well, then, if arrests are not necessarily an indicator of public safety, Meg, what effect do you think this law enforcement presence could have?
Yeah. So according to the White House, there have been over 2,000 federal officers involved in this crackdown on recent nights. And that's a big uptick, even in a city that, you know, at least according to data from 2022, had the highest number of police officers per capita in the country. And the White House has said that the National Guard and all these other officers are there to deter violent crime with a visible law enforcement presence. But, you know, police experts told me that officer visibility, like a squad car sitting on a corner, that can deter crime, but it's usually short-lived, and the more the police and the public interact, the greater the risk of excessive force.
That is NPR's Meg Anderson. Thank you, Meg.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered on this Friday evening here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30, and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. Brainerd Women of Today invite all ages to Chalk the Block, Monday, August 25th from 9:30 to 11 a.m. Spread positivity by drawing or writing uplifting messages on Laurel Street. Meet at Passport Restaurant. Support comes from AW Research Laboratories in Brainerd, reminding private well owners to test their drinking water annually. Common well contaminants such as bacteria, nitrates, and arsenic are odorless, tasteless, and colorless. More information and test kits available at awlab.com. Applications are now open for the University of Minnesota Extension Master Gardener Volunteer Program. Learn how to share science-based horticulture knowledge with people in your area. The course begins in January, and the deadline to apply is October 1st. To learn more, visit z.umn.edu or contact your local extension office. The Central Lakes College Ag and Energy Resource Center has its annual field day Friday, August 29th from 9 to 3 at their site in Staples. It's a day of hands-on demonstrations, education sessions, local food, and more. Find a schedule at clcagandenergy.org/events. And learn all about bats at the Zach Zim Bog Saturday, August 30th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. There will be both indoor and outdoor portions of this presentation. Registration required. Learn more at saxzim.org/events. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Wildlife officials in Montana are allowing more of the state's wolves to be hunted. As wolf populations have grown and spread, they're killing ranchers' livestock. And hunting is often cited as a tool to reduce conflict between humans and wildlife. So, does it work? Well, NPR's Nate Rott took a look at a new study which aims to answer that question. And a warning, there is the sound of a gunshot in this piece.
When the team of researchers that published this new study were starting out, they did a bunch of interviews with Western ranchers.
And conversations came up a lot where, you know, ranchers are just struggling.
Leander Murr is a co-author of the new study and researcher at San Diego State University, says they cited drought, wildfire, shifting economics.
But they're also now dealing with more predators. Livestock predation can be a huge challenge that we don't have a great solution for yet.
One of the proffered solutions in the Northern Rockies and now being talked about in Europe, which just voted to reduce protections for wolves in the European Union, is hunting.
We've often just fallen under this assumption that if wolves are the problem and we kill some of them, the problem isn't as bad.
The new study published in the journal Science Advances tested that theory, looking at how wolf hunting seasons in Idaho and Montana over the last decade and change have impacted livestock losses. Oregon and Washington, which have wolves, but no hunts, were used as a control.
We were surprised at how small the effect was.
Neil Carter is the senior author of the study and an associate professor at the University of Michigan.
Statistically significant, very, very small. In other words, you would have to hunt a lot of wolves.
According to their data, hunters would have to kill roughly 14 wolves to save one cow. There's an estimated 1,100 wolves in Montana. So if the state theoretically killed every one, which it cannot legally do, it would save roughly 78 cows.
The question is for policymakers, does it justify the use of this management tool for that purpose? Is this the most efficient way to do it?
Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks did not respond to a request for comment on the new study. Idaho Fish and Game says they wouldn't respond directly to it because they hadn't had an opportunity to read it thoroughly, but the agency did say it manages all predators with a variety of goals, including providing hunting opportunities, keeping predators in balance with other big game species, and reducing or minimizing social conflicts, which include livestock depredations. Wolf hunting, it probably goes without saying, is hugely controversial.
Map! Got it!
There are countless videos of wolf hunts on YouTube, like the one in Idaho you just heard. The hunts are constantly litigated, with wildlife advocates arguing wolves still haven't recovered across their historic range, and Republican-led legislatures, and in some cases, ranchers and sportsmen saying there are already too many wolves around. Murs says her team does not want this study to become a political talking point.
It almost could be used either way from either side to say like, oh, well, there is an effect, so we should keep hunting lots of wolves. Or there is only a small effect, so we shouldn't hunt any wolves.
Instead, she hopes it's used as a data point when weighing hunting against other alternatives to protect livestock, like range riding programs, which put a person out with livestock to scare away predators, or putting up flagging or fences. Because the debate is not going away. Earlier this year, a federal judge ordered the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to reassess whether wolves in the Northern Rockies deserve federal protections, citing, amongst other reasons, increasingly aggressive wolf hunting quotas and tactics in the Northern Rockies. Nate Rott, NPR News.
Now, here's a music performance that made history. This supercharged playing clinched the gold medal for Yoon-chan Lim, the youngest ever to win the Van Cliburn Piano Competition in 2022. He was only 18. Now the South Korean has a new Tchaikovsky album. Our reviewer, NPR's Tom Heisinga, says it raises lesser-appreciated music to new heights.
Let's be honest, The Seasons is not top-shelf Tchaikovsky. It's a set of 12 mid-tempo miniatures with descriptive titles, one for each month of the year in chronological order. That's how The Seasons starts, cozied up to a crackling fire in the month of January. But for Yoon-chan Lim, that fire isn't blazing, it's fizzling out. Lim has made up a storyline for the cycle. He sees it as the final somber year in an old man's life. But let's move on to February, carnival time. Whether you buy Lim's narrative or not, this album is evidence of his swelling romanticism. Lim has said, "I have made up my mind, I will live my life only for the sake of music." Sounds like something the Heart Ensleeve Tchaikovsky himself might say. And we're at the month of March, which offers some of Lim's best playing. Ethereal, as if improvised, almost jazz. Tchaikovsky's Seasons contains something of a hit single. It's the month of June, one of the composer's most wistful and beautiful melodies. Here's a moment to get molecular, to hear the Yoon-chan Lim difference. Let's compare how another pianist plays the opening phrase of June. Pavel Kolesnikov seems to measure each note with a ruler to make sure they're equidistant. Now hear Lim. His subtle rhythmic hesitations and delicate dynamics deliver an extra emotional tug. Lim is only 21, but he plays like an old soul. Here in the month of October, his featherlight touch intertwines a pair of heartbreaking melodies. Tchaikovsky's cycle concludes at Christmas, and Lim's old man is filled with regret. But you can't tell by this sweet waltz. In the end, Lim's storyline might not add up, but does it matter? The poetry of his performances has transformed these ordinary pieces into something extraordinary. And I've changed my mind about Tchaikovsky's Seasons.
The album is The Seasons by Yoon-chan Lim, and our reviewer is NPR's Tom Heisinga.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox presenting Outrageous, a new BritBox original drama based on the scandalous true story of England's infamous Mitford sisters. Streaming this and more original series at BritBox.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at Progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text or donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Bemidji Pride, announcing their annual festival for the LGBTQIA2S+ community and their allies at Railway River Folk School in Bemidji, August 23rd.